why are we here? Or can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things and breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
Well, it really does change from context to context. So, you know, for example, one of the issues in Cambodia is as young men being recruited to go and work on fishing boats in Thailand. And these are the very fishing boats that are sometimes stocking our supermarket shelves and providing the fish that we have, you know, on our Christmas table each year. And, you know, these young men, again, are promised much better working conditions than what they find when they get there. And often they don't dock for many years. They're never allowed off the boat. They're forced to keep working even when they're sick. Sometimes they're drugged. And unfortunately, there have been some extremely sad cases of men just being thrown overboard when they haven't been able to do the work.
That's Jo Pride. She's the CEO of an organisation called Hagar International. More from Jo in a moment.
Today on Life and Faith, we're talking about modern slavery and the attempts by one organisation to combat it. In our documentary on the history of Christianity, it was called For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined, and now available online if you'd like to check it out. We looked at slavery in the past, and we saw how Christianity and the Bible had been used over the centuries to defend the institution of slavery, which is quite perverse, really, because the faith that's all about individual freedom came, in some instances, to be a support to a system that exploited people as property. But we also saw how this was a distortion of the Bible, that Christianity came eventually to be critical to the abolitionist movement. Abolition became a Christian protest from people like William Wilberforce in the UK and Harriet Beecher Stowe in the US. And in the documentary, Rowan Williams has this great line where he basically says that by the 18th century, the anti-slavery movement is entirely the church's business. And he says, if the abolition of slavery had been left to enlightened secularists in the 18th century, we'd still be waiting.
Yeah, it was a bit provocative, wasn't it? Well, here is from the same documentary. Here's the theologian and historian David Bentley Hart talking about the long, complicated history of the church in relation to slavery.
Obviously, the most conspicuous example of the failure of Christian values to alter the thinking of its society rapidly is the case of slavery. I mean, slavery persisted throughout late antiquity. It did die out as a chattel system in the Christianized world, principally, I think, at first because the notion of one baptized Christian owning another was considered irregular more and more, but also just because of changes in economic conditions. But slavery persisted, and many of the church fathers, lamenting it as part of just the sad state of fallen humanity, but were not able to imagine a social or an economic reality in which it didn't exist. It was just an immemorial practice. But my favorite figure from the 4th century, Gregory of Nyssa, comes to mind, is an example of just of how disruptive the Christian moral imagination could still become. Because in 379, he preached what looks like the first abolitionist sermon. Certainly, it's a theological attack on slavery that's so uncompromising that it has absolutely no parallel anywhere in ancient literature.
Now, Hart is referring to Gregory of Nyssa, a church father writing in the 4th century, remember? And he's scathing of the institution of slavery. Gregory writes, "So when someone turns the property of God into his own property and arrogates dominion to his own kind so as to think of himself the owner of men and women, what is he doing but overstepping his own nature through pride, regarding himself as something different from his subordinates?" And Gregory goes on to say that humans have free will and slavery overturns God's intention for humanity. He says it's defying and fighting against the divine decree.
He doesn't mince words, does he? When it comes to slavery, many of us think that it's something in the past, not a contemporary problem.
Yeah, that's right. But it's alarming how much of a problem it is today. The International Labour Organization and Walk Free Foundation put out a report, and they estimate that 40.3 million people are held in slavery today. That's more than any other time in history. And around 25 million of that group are victims of what we call forced labour slavery, where they're coerced, they're underpaid or unpaid, and where, under the threat of violence, workers are made to stay in their roles, where conditions are often abusive and unsafe, and sometimes worse than that. And there are a lot of horror stories in this area.
Yeah, and around half of the world's slaves are in our Asia-Pacific region, and many are buried in this ecosystem of goods and services that we end up accessing through grocery stores and clothing outlets. So we are deeply embedded in the
problem. It's a web of complexity here, and you're exactly right. We've got a role in this, unfortunately.
So Walk Free Foundation, the organisation that produced this report, estimates that $12 billion worth of goods and services come to us each year via the misery and exploitation of people. So it is a serious and urgent contemporary problem.
Yeah, it really is. Now, Joe Pride is the CEO of the Australian branch of Hagar International. Now, this is an organisation that's dedicated to the recovery of particularly women and children who've endured the trauma of human trafficking, slavery and abuse. And they also agitate to end the cycle of modern slavery.
I am Sophia, and now I know love. As a child, I lived in fear. My mother beat me and abused me. When I was four, my father took me to the province and left me there.
Hagar works in Cambodia, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Singapore. We provide comprehensive services to people who have experienced extreme forms of abuse and exploitation.
When I spoke to Jo about her work, I began by asking her the significance of the name Hagar for the organisation.
Well, Hagar was one of the first slave women we know about in history. She was a slave to Abraham and Sarah, whose story is found in the Bible and also in the Torah and the Quran. And Hagar was forced to sleep with Abraham when her mistress Sarah was unable to fall pregnant. And Hagar fell pregnant and had a son. And at that point, Sarah became very jealous of her and cast her out into the desert. And it talks about an angel coming to visit her. And Hagar said, "You are the God who sees me." And Hagar's mission is really to see people that others don't see and to be able to help them in their point of distress and trauma.
You've chosen the name Hagar for that very reason, that we see you, we're trying to find life for people who otherwise are sort of the unseen and the discarded.
Absolutely. It's exactly that. It's about finding people that are in hidden places. And we know Hagar works with people that have been trafficked or abused or kept in slavery. And by its very nature, people who are in slavery are so often behind closed doors, or they're out at sea on ships, and they're in hidden places. And that's really what we're about, is finding those people.
How did Hagar, the organisation, get its start? How did this all come to be?
Hagar was started by an extraordinary man called Pierre Tami, who was living in Phnom Penh in 1994 with his family in Cambodia. And he really saw a need, particularly with the women and children living there. And he was very entrepreneurial. And so along with starting Hagar, he started a number of social enterprises that would provide employment opportunities for the women that we were helping. And so that's how it started. And it's continued. We're still headquartered in Cambodia. So it's a really interesting structure where we have very small offices in countries like Australia, raising funds and awareness. But most of our staff are doing the hard work on the ground with the clients that we serve.
Yeah, well, I want to talk to you about that. It's been going for about 20 years now. You must know some stories of people, women, children you've come across through Hagar's work. What are some of the ones that have really struck you?
I think, you know, naturally I was really struck by the very first client that I met on my first trip to Cambodia, and her name was Melis, and she had a very difficult family situation. Her mother had left her with her grandmother in Cambodia and had disappeared over the border into Thailand, and she'd had a great childhood with her grandmother, but they were very poor, and eventually their land was taken from them, and Melis went off at the age of 14 to try and find a job so that she could help her grandmother pay rent. And she, as is so often the case, was promised a great job working in a market for a good businessman where she would be able to go home on holidays and see her grandmother and would earn what was for her a good salary of $25 a week.
I'm going to guess it didn't turn out like that.
It really didn't turn out like that. So when she arrived, she was constantly watched the whole time. She was forced to work very long hours. She was never paid the money that she was promised, and she was never allowed to go home and see her grandmother. And then, unfortunately, she was sexually abused by the owner of that business and by a number of other men as well. And she fell pregnant. And so eventually another business owner in the market took pity on her and helped her to escape. And to cut what is a very long and complex story short, she found her way to Hagar when she was 7 months pregnant, incredibly depressed, wanting to take her own life, and with no hope for the future. And when I met her, it was some months later, and she'd given birth to a beautiful son, and she had decided that she wanted to keep him and be his mother. And she was starting to show the signs of being able to heal from what had happened, but it was so early on, and the trauma was still very apparent. And I was very moved by meeting her.
What would Hagar typically do with someone like that? What's the program? I think it's a quite holistic program, right?
Absolutely. So we call it the whole journey, and we focus firstly on ensuring they're safe, so finding protection for them. So wherever it's safe, we would love to see them be reintegrated with their own family, but of course that's not always a safe option. And so often we'll look for an alternative amongst their extended family. And again, if that's not possible, we will find a foster care family for them to go and live with. We have an amazing legal team that provides legal support. And so in Melis's case, we were able to support her through to see the prosecution of some of the men who had sexually abused her, to see her be paid some compensation by them. One of the things we're known for best globally is how do you help people recover from trauma? And so we have some extraordinary counsellors that know exactly how to take people on that journey. And it can be a very long journey sometimes to recover from such deep trauma. And then we have extraordinary education and economic empowerment programs. So helping our clients to catch up on school when they might never have had the opportunity to go to school before, to be able to learn vocational skills or perhaps to go to university and ultimately to find a great job that will support them to live independently of Hagar.
You sometimes hear frightening and almost unbelievable statistics about people who are in these sorts of situations. We might call them modern slaves. When you're faced with such a vast task, what keeps you and the people at Hagar motivated? How do you kind of, does it ever just look too hard and overwhelming?
It certainly can be overwhelming when you look at the statistics, but I think what weighs against that is when you see these extraordinary lives that have been transformed. And, you know, one of the other young women that really has a special place in my heart, a young woman called Sophia. And Sophia had a very similar sad story to Melis, you know, sold at the age of 4 and kept in slavery until she was finally able to escape when she was 12. But I met Sophia when she was 24, and actually I had no idea when I first met her that she was one of our clients, because she was so confident. She's now a graduate of a Bachelor of Social Work from university. She's working to empower young women in Cambodia through education. And last year she took her first plane trip ever and left Cambodia and came to Australia and actually gave evidence to our parliament on what Australia needs to do to tackle this issue. And so what was clear to me with Sophia is the trauma that she had experienced was still very real to her as well, even all these years later. But there were more smiles than there were tears, and hope had really replaced the despair that had once been there. And I think when you see that deep transformation of a life, it really does inspire you to keep going.
I bet it does. It's amazing. The organisation's in a bunch of places, Cambodia, Afghanistan, Vietnam. They're very challenging environments. What are the sorts of things vulnerable people are facing in these places? There is some of the things you've described already, but what else?
Well, it really does change from context to context. So looking to Vietnam, a very different situation there. One of the challenges that we're dealing with there is a legacy of the one-child policy in China, where there are now many more Chinese men living in China than there are Chinese women. And so that's created a real demand for sex work and for wives. And so we're seeing a lot of Vietnamese women being trafficked over the border into China to be put into forced marriage or to be forced to do sex work. And if they're able to escape and make their way back to Vietnam, then we're able to help them when they arrive there.
Joe, it seems that there are both issues here, the systemic problems that are deep and difficult to challenge, and also picking up the pieces for people who have experienced these terrible things. What's the best way to go about it? Which end do you need to go at?
You really need to work at both ends. And so at that systemic level, this is a really complex issue. Like I said, slavery is so often hidden behind closed doors. And even when we're looking at it in the context of the products that we buy here in Australia, we might have companies that are doing their due diligence at that first tier of suppliers, but actually they might have a factory that's making clothes ethically, but the cotton is not produced ethically. And so that you really need to look deep into those supply chains. And so tackling it at a systemic level really means a whole lot of different stakeholders coming together: governments, companies, charities like Hagar, academics that are researching these issues. And the Australian government has done a really good job of bringing those stakeholders together in what's called our National Roundtable on Human Trafficking and Slavery. And I have the opportunity to sit on that and to look at what that holistic response is. And of course, we love to be able to encourage our supporters to make the right choices when they are purchasing products, to be able to tell the brands that they love to buy from that this is an issue that's important to them, and to encourage Australian companies to keep tackling this issue at its source. On the other hand, there are 40 million people that are currently caught in slavery, and these are people who have been through horrific circumstances, and we do need to help them and to really see them as individuals. And I guess that's really the core of what Hagar does.
This is Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity.
Today we're bringing you an interview with Jo Pride. She's the CEO of Hagar Australia. It's an international organisation that works with people impacted by human trafficking, slavery and abuse. They also work to end the cycle of modern slavery.
Yes, which is why they're very interested in the Modern Slavery Act, which was passed late in 2018 in the Australian Federal Parliament. Now, this Modern Slavery Act introduces a bunch of things, including mandatory reporting for large corporations with a global annual revenue of $100 million and above. Now, these companies are going to be required to publish annual statements on their actions to address modern slavery in their supply chains and operations. Often these things are buried deep in the supply chains. It takes a lot of work, actually, to uncover this. Now, the hope is that the reporting will mean that modern slavery risks will be considered at the very highest level of these companies, that they'll take it very seriously and sort of work against it. So I asked Jo Pride what she thinks the Modern Slavery Act will achieve.
Yeah, well, we're really excited about this. This has been a long-term, advocacy focus for so many organisations working on this issue in Australia. And this year, finally, the Australian government announced that it would this year pass a Modern Slavery Act here in Australia. And what that legislation will do is that it will require any organisation, whether it's a company or a not-for-profit or a faith-based organisation that has a turnover each year of $100 million, and they will be required to report at board level on the steps that they're taking to ensure there's no slavery in their supply chains.
You're right, so they have to be actively doing things to oppose this rather than just reporting, oh no, there's nothing to see here.
Really, what we want to achieve with this legislation is to encourage companies to go and look. I think at the moment, perhaps some of them are being discouraged to look because they're a little bit scared about what they might find.
Yeah.
But actually, we want to change the culture of that so that we can celebrate, not that people are being in slavery, but that when we find it, we can then do something about it. And to really champion the companies that are, above all, being very transparent about what they're doing on this, that are being open with their consumers about these are the steps that we're taking. Yes, we might not have it all right yet, but we are committed to getting it right over the time. And so that's the culture we're trying to build.
Now, initially, Hagar was helping women and girls and they're still doing that, but also now trafficked boys. And I'm particularly interested in this Forgotten No More Boys program. It's in Afghanistan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Hagar is the only organisation that has a program specifically for boys in Kabul, Afghanistan. It's a very different context there, obviously. What we see is that women and girls are largely behind closed doors and dealing with issues such as forced marriage or severe domestic violence. But it's the boys that are out on the street. They might be running errands for their families or just going to school and are much more vulnerable to trafficking in Kabul. And so that's why we've had a need to create a program specifically for them. And at the very severe end of the spectrum of the boys that we're helping, there are boys who have escaped from being dancing boys, where they've been required to dress in drag, sometimes wear makeup and dance for the entertainment of the men that they are slaves to. And so obviously that's a very traumatic situation. It's known as bachabazi in Afghanistan, and it's our honour and privilege to be able to help those boys rebuild their lives.
Yeah. Is there any hope of tackling the problem itself in that situation? Or is it more, let's grab these kids at the end of it and help them?
I think that's a particularly difficult issue because it's so deeply entrenched there. We are doing some really interesting work in Afghanistan to tackle trafficking at its source. So we've been involved in a big project that is looking at border towns around Afghanistan, looking at what are the reasons why people are being trafficked over the border in either direction, how can we prevent that, and how do we safely refer them to the right services when they are repatriated to their country. And we do that work in partnership with governments, in partnership with civil society and journalists, with religious leaders, which is very important when you're working in Afghanistan. And it really does require that multi-stakeholder approach where everyone's working towards the same goal. And that's been an extraordinary program to be a part of.
What was it, Joe, that led you personally to this organisation? What was it that drew you to this work?
I think just a fundamental unacceptance that this treatment of human beings can happen in this modern day, and such a strong desire to want to do something about that. I just find it so difficult to understand that as a human race, we let this happen, and that there are 40 million people around the world that are in slavery. And I think just a compassion for the individuals and the depth of the hurt and the injury and the trauma that they have experienced, and a very strong desire to want to help them to get through that.
And how's it affected you personally? These sorts of things can get pretty jaded by it or even traumatised by it.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that we need to do very carefully at Hagar is to really look at what kind of self-care we are encouraging our staff to take of themselves, and how they can protect themselves, particularly the frontline workers that are hearing these stories every day, the counsellors, the case managers, but really for all staff. It does affect me. I'm a mother of two kids. I've got an 8-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter. And I often get back from, visiting our programs overseas and reflect on some of the children that I've met there and just the life of contrast compared to how blessed that my children are living in Australia with all of the access to education and such a peaceful situation that they get to live in. And there are moments that I get quite teary at my desk reading some of these stories. I obviously get exposed to a lot of them, and sometimes you can get a bit desensitized, and then every now and then one will just come through and really shock you and get you deep in the stomach and really affect you.
Is there a spiritual element to what Hagar does? What are you hoping to achieve spiritually within this work?
Well, we're a Christian organisation, but I think that really speaks to our motivation and why we feel so driven to do something about these issues. In terms of the clients that we support, we clearly don't discriminate based on anyone's faith, and we will help anyone. And we also don't, necessarily require them or encourage them to accept our faith either. Interestingly, I would make the observation that in a number of our clients, their spiritual faith has played a very deep and central role in their ability to recover from trauma. One of the things that I find really interesting, because all of the countries that we work in are post-conflict countries, is what causes some people to, after, you know, being through serious conflict like the Khmer Rouge years in Cambodia, to on the one hand perhaps become a perpetrator of the types of crimes that Hagar is responding to. On the other hand, we have these people who become extraordinary foster parents because they experience what it was like not to have their own parents, and they therefore want to help other children. And again, in many cases, it comes down to a spiritual faith that inspires them to want to help others.
Has this experience made you more or less positive about human nature? You must have your dark days.
It's a really good question, and it probably changes from day to day is the answer to that. There are some days that I feel extremely sad about human nature and shocked, in fact, about what humans are capable of. But I think what I've found incredibly inspirational is how resilient the human spirit can be and how people ultimately do want to thrive and how they'll put everything behind rebuilding their lives, but also the extraordinary commitment of staff that are willing to live in very dangerous situations. And I think particularly there of our staff working on the ground in Kabul who's putting their own lives at danger by doing this work, and the courage that they show and the commitment they show to do this work is amazing. And I also get incredibly inspired by the generosity of some of our supporters. That still surprises me these days, that people really are willing to invest in this work, and it's so encouraging for us to see that.
Sometimes when you're not the person going to help, but you see the stats and you hear these stories, it can feel really overwhelming. You can feel quite helpless. There are various organisations doing this work, but yours is certainly one that people could jump in and contribute to. How can they best do that?
Well, I think for Hagar, you know, we've been around for 24 years now, and what I'd say is we have really learnt how to do this well over that time. We've helped to transform 16,000 lives, and you know, I see us as a real leader in this field, and so one of the challenges for us is that this work is long-term, you know, and we need predictable funding sources. When we take someone in and we say, we are here for as long as it takes to rebuild your life, we need to know that we're going to be able to be around in 5 years' time to be able to continue to support them. Otherwise, who is there for them? And so that kind of predictable, you know, regular donations are so important to us, and we always welcome them. People can find out more on our website, which is www.hagar.org.au.
And Jo, have you been able to keep track of mailers? How's she doing now?
Yes, absolutely. So we do continue to support our clients for a couple of years once they're reintegrated into the community. And in Maylis's case, she is working for a bakery in Phnom Penh, earning an income to support her young son. She's a wonderful young mother. You know, the compensation that she was given from the perpetrators of her abuse was not significant. And so she is wanting to challenge that and see if they can provide more. She's now facing a life as a very young single mum and needing to bring up her son, but she's got a great foundation.
This has been Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity with me, Simon Smart, and Justine Toe. Now, if you're interested to find out more about the work of Hagar, you can find them easily on the net at Hagar, that's hagar.org.au.
And I hope you've enjoyed this conversation. And if you have, why don't you let your friends know about Life and Faith? Help spread the word.
Next week, Simon, Natasha and I are going to lift the lid on Easter. We're going to be talking about the articles we're writing, the things that we're thinking about, and why it should matter today. See you then.
Okay.
Hey, rolling.
Oh. Hi, I'm Anna, the youth...
Start again, you peaked.
Sorry. Okay. Hi. I'm Anna, the youth editor here at CPX, just jumping in for a minute to talk to you about what may be the most exciting podcasting opportunity of 2019. Is there a burning question you want to explore? Or a story you think isn't being told? If you're between the ages of 15 and 21, or you know someone who is, our second annual Life and Faith Youth Competition is now open. Pitch us your story by the 10th of May for a chance to produce an episode of the podcast. Life and Faith needs you. Head to cpxyouth.org for all the details. It's fine. Is that okay?